Hello and welcome to the Sewers of Paris. We're on a podcast adventure to discover the entertainment that changed the lives of gay men. Join us on tonight's episode when my guest George Alley talks about how he got along with the other neighborhood children.
At one time, I was stripped, shirtless, and tied to a chair while they interrogated me.
The topic is Suzy Sue, Nirvana, The Cure, and Sonic Youth. My guest this week is George Alley, a musician and choreographer who paid his dues on the mean streets of suburban Cleveland, where he was the secretary for a local street gang. The son of a Detroit blues singer and a demolition derby driver, George often felt anger at the world and at the people who tormented him. That anger, it turned out, would be a crucial element that shaped his creative work today. I'll have an excerpt of George's latest single, Leave Me Dreaming, at the end of this week's episode. But first, I want to let you know about some big plans for the Sewers of Paris in 2018. Starting in February, I'm going to be making monthly bonus episodes with even more personal stories about entertainment that's changed the lives of queer people. And on top of that, I'll be hosting live streams that you can join, creating new YouTube videos about LGBT entertainment, and more. Of course, you'll still get a new episode of The Sewers of Paris every Thursday, just like always. The show's not changing, there's just going to be more of it. The Sewers of Paris is possible because of listeners like you who pledge a dollar or more to keep it going. And starting in February, those contributions will support even more content. There's also going to be rewards for people who pledge, more information on that as we get closer to February. To everyone already supporting the Sewers of Paris on Patreon, huge thanks. There'll be a few tweaks to the way pledges are charged, and I'll be in touch with you about that. And to everyone who hasn't pledged yet, February is going to be a great time to start. Just head to sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon. If you're not able to support the show financially, there's other ways you can help, just by listening, tweeting about the show, following the Sewers of Paris on Twitter and Facebook, and by writing reviews. All of that is a huge help, and I'm very, very grateful. I can't wait to show you what I got in the works for 2018. Now, here's George. Well, this week I'm talking to George Alley, musician, choreographer, multimedia artist. George, thanks so much for joining me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
Well, I was very into sort of fish-out-of-water movies as a child. Movies like Hello Again with Shelley Long. And
I totally don't know that one.
Oh, yeah. It's her second. It was right after she did Troop Beverly Hills.
Okay.
Movies like that. Movies like Jumping Jack Flash with Whoopi Goldberg.
Mm-hmm.
Protocol with Goldie Hawn.
These are very grown up. Like, they're not like... These aren't like deep movies exactly, but they certainly are movies for like 30-something couples like who want something a little more serious.
I think it just these sort of people resonated with me, these very individualistic women.
Yeah, so can you describe, like, because I am not really knowledgeable about these films, so...
Mm-hmm. Well, there's Troop Beverly Hills, and then Hello Again. In Troop Beverly Hills, which I probably watched about 50 times, you know, she plays a rich housewife who's suddenly taken upon herself to head her daughter's Girl Scout troop.
Mm-hmm.
Finds herself sort of having to deal with working with sort of more common people than she's used to. And then Hello Again, she plays a woman who is sort of a suburban housewife, and her husband is a plastic surgeon who gets promoted into a high-powered position at a major hospital. And then he starts having an affair with another woman, and... She chokes on a Korean chicken ball and finds it, and she dies. But then she's resurrected by her medium sister. She wakes up a year later, and her husband is married to Celia Ward. And she finds out that his whole lifestyle has changed. And, you know, she's trying to sort of keep up with that.
Like, as a ghost?
Yeah, so she has to find true love within a year, or she will be she'll go back to the grave. But she has a year to sort of find true love. It's sort of this movie where she realizes that you know, the trappings of success are not rewarding, and she falls in love with this man who saves her. And she becomes famous. So yeah, I guess I just like that movie because she's sort of put in this situation that has nothing to do with her. Those kinds of movies sort of made sense to me. I didn't feel like I was someone that fit in exactly with my environment.
How are you?
What am I doing in this dress?
Mom, I don't think you've realized the importance of what's happened to you.
It's earth-shattering.
It would change the way people look at life.
By any chance, do you know what's happened on Knott's Landing?
Shelley Long is Lucy Chatman.
Lucy who?
And Lucy Chadwin's life just hasn't been the same since her death.
Sometimes you can get incredibly powerful vibrations from old brassieres, but yours just had a slight hum.
And so things like that, Whoopi Goldberg in Jumping Jack Flash, she's working in a bank in New York, and then she finds herself having to become a spy because there's just this sort of pre-internet chat. Somehow her computer gets transferred to, and she gets a hold of this spy who then is looking for help, and she's the only one who can help him. And she's completely out of her league. All of these sort of hijinks ensue.
So when you said that you were drawn to fish out of water stories, I was thinking, okay, well, like, so Wizard of Oz and Adventures in Babysitting. What on earth did these movies about very grown-up problems, like finding love? Like, why did, I don't want to call them middle-aged excess, but like not children's films. Like, did you watch children's movies? Or were you just like, oh yeah, 30-something's my favorite TV show?
I mean, my favorite movie is Clue, which, okay. I think a lot of gay people like Clue of my generation, but I always sort of identified with older people. I'd much rather talk to other adults than I wanted to talk to people my age.
How did adults feel about that?
They were into me. I was friends with a lot of my mother's friends and would go out with them and talk about the IRA or, you know, I was very obsessed with the Iran-Iraq war.
Things and you were like all that.
How old? Like, you know, third grade, second grade.
Okay, so I'm just like picturing you like sitting around the canasta table and everybody's gossiping about, like, I don't know, the church potluck or something. Did you have friends your own age?
I did. There was a club called the Viper Club. And it was a group, it was sort of a gang of boys in my neighborhood. And I was the secretary of the club. And I was sort of a rival with the president of the club, Paul. And I created a newsletter with him. I was the person that had to do the newsletter, and they didn't like the information that I had in the newsletter. And so then they kicked me out of the club. So then I started my own club called the British Club. Originally, I called it the Malta Islands Club because I was really intrigued by the Malta Islands. And I wrote to the president of the Malta Islands to ask for his sponsorship, but he did not respond. And so then I was angry and I called it the British Club because I'm half Scottish and half Lebanese. I convinced some of the members of the Viper Club, including the treasurer, to leave the Viper Club and declare war on the Viper Club.
We have a lot to investigate here. First of all, what exactly was the Viper Club? Were you like in a gang of hooligans?
Sort of. I mean, when it was first just the Viper Club, we had no one else that we were at war with. And we were looking for recruits, and we were looking, I remember we looked at these kids that were down the street, but we decided they were too young. But it was then funny because then one of them ended up being my brother-in-law. We were like mostly about mapping out the neighborhood and creating vehicles that we were going to make to sort of patrol the neighborhood, you know, sort of make these declarations of the neighborhood. And we had there was sort of some of these weird sexual situations as well, because I remember once like one of them wanted me to basically put balloons down my shirt and act like I had breasts and do this dance to Mr. Telephone Man by New Edition. So there was a lot of weird things going on.
To what end was that idea floated? Like, were you trying to seduce the like passersby? Like, what was going on with the Viper Club?
It was a very sexually charged club of like, you know, five boys. And it was a little bit like Stand By Me. There was a little bit of that sort of element going on. And there was a very competitive thing going on between me and the leader of the club. And then once I started the British Club, we declared war on them and put ketchup all over their bicycles. And at one time, I was stripped shirtless and tied to a chair while they interrogated me.
This sounds brutal. Like, were you growing up in, like, Brooklyn in the 1800s? Sounds like one of those stories that, like, never can happen anymore because parents are always structuring their children's time. But, like, when and where was this happening?
It was suburban Cleveland in the 80s.
Well, we all know the notorious gangs of suburban Cleveland of the 1980s.
Yeah. And then I ended up declaring, I'd sent out this United Nations. I decided I wanted to create peace because there was so much war going on. And I sent out this declaration saying there would be a United Nations of clubs and sent it out saying, you must join this United Nations club or you will be declared war upon. And then suddenly these new clubs came out of nowhere and then declared war on us just because they were so angry I had made this declaration.
Wow. And so aside from the ketchup on the bicycles, like, what did war look like?
Destroying other people's forts, tying them up, burning their Garbage Pail Kid collection, things like that.
Oh, that is brutal. I definitely recall, like, because I grew up in the 80s as well in Connecticut, and I definitely remember the importance of forts, like how important those are. And I don't know if that's something that kids have today or not.
No, I think we're sort of the last generation that had, you know, sort of free reign to go outside and not be monitored in the same way. You know, that's something that I know certainly my nephews don't have, but, you know, millennials, I don't think had that either. I think that sort of last, you know, whatever we are, sort of that XY area is the people who were born in the late 70s and early 80s are sort of the last people that had that kind of experience.
Looking back at that, the amount of, it sounds like bondage that was going on in this club and the burgeoning cabaret career that you were encouraged to have.
Yeah. I had an agent. I do remember that.
Stop. You had an agent?
There was sort of this, I remember this coach coming out. First of all, Paul had stripped naked and had done a strip tease. And then I came out and did this sort of drag cabaret performance. But I remember this guy, Jamie, was like coaching me behind stage, put these under your, you know, put these balloons under your shirt and do this routine.
And where exactly were you performing?
In a basement, you know, one of the kids' basements somewhere.
Sure. Okay. So one kid does a striptease, complete striptease by the sound of it.
Yes.
You're out there doing a drag number. Mm-hmm. Was this gang possibly a bunch of little queer boys, or is it just like preteen boys exploring what sex is?
You know, it's hard to say. I know there was definitely a lot of sexual tension going. I think there's a lot of sexual tension at that age.
Not to mention there's just a lot of question marks.
For sure. I mean, and for some reason I was often one of the ones that was chosen to do. We had a series of movies that we filmed called Mask, and I played this sort of Jamie Lee Curtis type character in this series, okay. Which was very loosely based on Halloween, of course. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was constantly taking off my shirt and then being attacked while all my friends were dying and, you know, running and screaming while this mask character came after us.
This is going to feel like jumping around in time quite a bit, but can you just describe the work that you do today?
So I write music and I've put out songs. I also talk about music. I'm a professor. I teach a class about punk and DIY. And then I'm a choreographer, and I have a dance company called Alley Ink Dance. And I'm also occasionally a writer. And I had a festival for many years called Collage Festival here in Philadelphia, which was a multimedia arts festival where over 60 artists each year would perform. And I co-curated that festival with three other artists.
And in your work, is there sort of a thesis to the work that you're doing? I know you mentioned DIY and punk as being something that was important to you.
For sure. I mean, I think my own music and then the music that, and then all of my other work, whether it's writing or visual work is very much, or my choreography is very much under that ethos of do-it-yourself and punk and the sort of art of refusal that comes along with that, that sort of philosophy behind that.
So when people are looking at, for example, your music videos, what are they seeing?
My music videos are very much about myself in a way. You know, they're about me creating a space for myself. And
to do what?
I think that I've always been a performer primarily because I wanted to own space to a certain degree, and I wanted to feel like it was a safe way for me to communicate how I felt. And because I was teased a lot as a child, or a little bit once I turned about 12, you know, this was sort of my way of getting back at those people and saying, look, now you have to look at me. And so becoming a performer and becoming a performer in a way where I was creating my own space really helped me with that.
Did you feel like people weren't looking at you when you were younger?
I think people were looking at me a lot, but for negative reasons. So I was very, you know, when I was in seventh or eighth grade, I was really, really teased to the point where my parents had a meeting with the principal of the school, and they said, you need to take him out of the school because we can't protect him anymore. And so
the school told your parents they need to take you out?
Yes. So
what did you need to be protected from? Like, was it just verbal, or like did it get physical?
Oh, it was physical, sexual, and definitely verbal. I mean, I think from, you know, I'd gone from being a very popular kid, having these clubs, and you know, then once sort of sexuality hit for people and they started to realize that I was gay, I went from being really popular to being sort of a pariah, to the point where if you would, you know, because it was sort of the neighborhood that I grew up in was a Catholic Italian neighborhood, even though I'm not either of those, you know, it was a conservative neighborhood in the late 80s to be clearly a gay person, and people were pointing out to me that I was gay before I was able to verbalize that I was gay. I think that that's why, you know, the music that I make or the dances I created were because I wanted control over the way that people saw me.
So how did you want them to see you?
I think that I wanted to show that I was angry at the situation that I was in. I think I wanted to, you know, sort of make commentary about gender expression.
So how did you, like, initially, looking back on some of your earlier work, like, how did you express that anger?
Well, I mean, I think a lot, I was very influenced by, I was really into Dimon de Galas in high school, and Susie Sue and Robert Smith of The Cure.
And do you have favorite songs?
My favorite song by Dimon de Galas is Double Barrel Prayer. And then, you know, I love, maybe my favorite Susie song is Christine. I really like the song Happy House, which is a sort of reflection on a suburban household that's, if you look behind the surface, you see that there's all this darkness underneath. And I sort of always like these sort of reflections on sort of normal life and making commentary on that. And I was probably very influenced by the way that she or other artists, punk artists like Johnny Rotten of the Sex Pistols, were making commentary about class and gender and race and sort of all of the ugliness that's underneath.
I want to talk some more about that, but I also need a little closure on the United Nations and the British Club and like what happened with everything.
After I was declared war, and that was about it. I mean, we had the most successful thing I did was get the treasurer of the Viper Club to join my team, the British Club, and then I immediately made him not the treasurer so that I could take all the money from the Viper Club and spend it.
Oh, so the treasurer got to take the money with him?
He had it in his house, so I then I told him he shouldn't be the treasurer anymore and took the money.
What did the British Club spend the money on?
Well, the British Club then turned into one of my first newsletters, which then, you know, I started doing a lot in high school. It turned into zines, but my first newsletter was a write-in newsletter that I had in the back of Astrology magazine, where you could subscribe to this magazine, that this newsletter that would talk about everything from Super Mario Brothers to, you know, the moons of Saturn to, you know, geology or whatever it was that was interesting to me at the time.
So you had, you're just sort of putting out this sort of proto-zine about just whatever your interests were. And then it sounds like that was sort of a detente there where all the clubs went their own way.
Oh, yeah. They eventually disintegrated, and then the British Club, the main members of the British Club, we started making movies and like home movies, and you know, I started to sing more, and at first I had a singing group with these other members of the British Club, but they weren't very good. It was called Starlight. And
what was the aesthetic of Starlight?
Very influenced by the new Mickey Mouse Club. I was one of the first people. We got cable very early. We got cable in 1984. So we got a subscription to MTV and the Disney Channel, and so I was just watching music videos all the time. I was watching the countdown at the end of New Year's at my parents' parties. I would sort of predict for my parents' friends what would be the next, what would be in the top 10 this year.
What were your guesses? Were you good at that?
I was good at that. Yeah. So I remember once predicting that Bon Jovi, You Give Love a Bad Name would be number one, and my parents' friends were very impressed with my prediction. And I was very into the new Mickey Mouse Club, and that became sort of a thing that I auditioned for, and I got to the second round of auditions, which was the same sort of round that I got to the same level as Jessica Simpson did, but then I didn't get to the next part. But I wrote a book for Young Authors Day about me becoming the next Mouseketeer and what would happen and how I would solve all these crimes that were going on in the new Mickey Mouse Club at the time.
I love that as a premise, that the Mouseketeers have to solve crimes within their ranks.
Yes.
That's really that is a strong pitch.
Yeah, I think it could be turned into a film today, perhaps. So I started seeing that as sort of an avenue for me to sort of escape being bothered and stuff, was to become famous. And that's
yeah, because famous people never get bothered.
Right. Their lives are so easy.
Yeah, everyone wants to leave famous people alone. If there's one thing people want to do about famous people, it's leave them alone.
Yeah, and not talk to them at all.
So I presume that your interest in the Mickey Mouse Club predated your interest in Susie Sue.
I mean, there were certain musicians that became very important to me that I was influenced by an early age. I saw Boy George on the A-Team, which was huge for me because I saw this person that was in some way like me, and that was kicking down a door and working with Mr. T, but was also incredibly glamorous and was the singer.
Yeah,
and mysterious.
I have no memory of Boy George on the A-Team. What was he doing there?
He was booked for a concert in Arizona. And they thought they were booking Cowboy George, but they accidentally booked Boy George.
Oh my God, this just gets better and better.
And so then there's all of these hijinks that ensue because the cowboys in the town are saying, we don't want no English glitter prince with his glitter eye makeup. And Boy George doesn't want to do it either. And he says, this place is a certified toilet. And And then all of the, someone gets kidnapped and then Boy George ends up helping them and he becomes part of the A-team and he picks a lock with a bobby pin in his hair and then he knocks down a door, kicks a door down and says, totally awesome, Hannibal.
Tuesday, guess who's coming to the A-team?
Boy George and the Culture Club.
And the action is
too marvelous for words.
So get in on the act, because things are going to be rocking and stomping.
What next?
When Boy George meets the A-team, Tuesday.
I'm rolling.
This sounds amazing, and it sounds like some fan fiction that never actually happened, but I'm so pleased that it did.
You need to watch it.
What was the effect to you? Well, like, what did it mean to you to see this?
It was somebody who, and this part, when I saw him at the A-team, I wasn't being teased, but, you know, I still recognize that this was somebody who was carving their own space, that was presenting themselves in a way that made sense to them, that was glamorous, that was beyond sort of the mundane trappings of a suburban life. And I saw him and thought, like, this is a really mysterious, glamorous person. And that followed me until later when my senior year of undergrad, where I wrote a thesis about Boy George and gender-bending pop icons.
It sounds like you had a period where you're sort of experimenting with, where is the space where I can really be me? Do I have to sort of conform to a very pop-friendly Mouseketeer sort of version of myself, or can I just be really angry and off-putting and weird and just do my own thing? So, like, those two things seem like there must have been an intense conflict.
Oh, for sure. I think I really wanted for a while to fit in, and I think maybe because I looked darker than everyone else there and because I was acting gayer than everyone else, that I didn't realize that that wasn't going to happen for me. So that started this sort of, and just being bothered so much and not being able to figure out how to sort of fix that. You know, a few things fixed it. One is my parents were able to put me into a private school where I wasn't bothered.
So they actually did take you out of the school?
Oh, yeah. They had to. There was, I know that if I was lucky that that happened, I know that I wouldn't have, like, I would probably have killed myself or something would have happened if I had stayed there because it was so extreme. Yeah, so that happened. And then I didn't really have friends in this private school until maybe my junior, senior year. But I started to have this group of sort of other outcasts in some way. Like, some of them ended up being gay. Some of them were just different. And we started to create a zine, a satanic zine called The Ha, and started a band called Alien Flavors that everyone in the high school hated. But they were sort of empowering, and it sort of was this shift from this sort of Mouseketeer, me wanting to fit in, to sort of, and punk was happening in a new way by then because you had grunge suddenly happen. You had all these bands in the early 90s like Nirvana and Hole and The Breeders and Veruca Salt and Liz Phair that were expressing themselves in an angry way, and in a way that was, you know, let's forget about presenting ourselves like everyone else. And that empowered me to, and Sonic Youth, of course, to be sort of more aggressive myself. Plus the
fact led you, what led you to create a satanic zine in high school?
The band that we had, Alien Flavors, we auditioned for the school talent show and were rejected with our song Butter Your Body for Satan, Eat the Ho-Hos. But, but, you know, the zine was a way to sort of express ourselves. And it was a way, because we weren't even being allowed to perform for this talent show, that here was a way to, like, create our own venue. And that was what was so exciting about making this scene, was it wasn't monitored in any way. I could say what I wanted to. I could talk about Satan. I could talk about death or whatever I wanted to talk about. And I had a lot of anger because I had just been bothered so much. And I think also I was kind of angry about being gay, and then angry that any sort of a gay experiences I was starting to have were negative. And so that sort of led into this sort of creative whirlwind that became things like that zine.
How serious were you about Satanism, and how much was that just a way to talk about being annoyed at everybody else?
Oh, it was using that symbol of pentagram or whatever in the same way that punks use anything. The, you know, punks in the 70s using a swastika were not really pro-Hitler. They were using it to piss off their parents. And the same way I was talking about Satanism, I didn't really believe in Satan, but I knew that if I talked about Satanism, it would piss off people, and that excited me.
So what did you believe in?
I believed in myself and creating this world. And I mean, I've had a lot of close friends and close family, and I've always really cared about those people and kind of shut out the outside world. So I have that. I was always cared about the people that were close to me and my family.
How did your family like your artistic expression during that time?
I think it was challenging a little bit, but I, you know, my mom was in a band in high school. I mean, not in high school. She was in a band after she was in college in Detroit called Electric Shit. And my dad was a demolition derby driver. And so they weren't like, they were more open-minded than I think a lot of parents would be. But
these sound like the world's most exciting parents.
they're very cool people. They, you know, I talk to them every day. But yeah, and they grew up in Detroit, and my mom particularly was part of this music scene, and you know, knew people, like, you know, ran into people a lot, like Iggy Pop or Alice Cooper and other people that were in Detroit at that time. So, you know, they didn't want me to be bothered, and so some of the things that I did, whether it was wearing makeup or... They didn't want me to be beaten up, and they didn't want me to be harassed. And so there were things that would bother them about what I was doing because they didn't want anything to happen to me, but they weren't, but that was what they're upset, would be upset about.
Yeah. How much do you think you're a product of, like, how much did you recapitulate their younger years? Like, were you just reliving the sort of punk scene that they came from?
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely part of a sort of proto-punk scene. I mean, my mom, particularly, you know, because all of that music, the Stooges and MC5, turned into what influenced the New York Dolls and the Sex Pistols and the Clash. They were all listening to Iggy Pop, and so to a certain degree, yeah, I guess I am really following down that line that my mom also was exploring with years earlier.
Well, so describe for me, like, when you started feeling like all of your searching through different aesthetics and through different bands and things, when did you start figuring out, okay, this feels right, this is where I belong?
I don't know if I ever felt like I belonged. I do think that there were specific artists that I always really enjoyed and that I resonated with. Like, you know, Pete Burns of Dead or Alive was a particular person that his philosophy and, you know, there's this great interview with Pete Burns where, on the show Walk on the Wild Side, where he says, you know, if I haven't made a song today, at least I've made myself. And that's a creative, you know, that's a creative experience, and that saves me from having destructive tendencies. So, like, his idea is that sort of him being himself, which is a very dandyist kind of idea, this idea of you being yourself is a piece of art, you know, and so that living your own life and living your experience and, you know, is an artistic practice.
So how did that manifest in the art that you were making?
Well, I think that I started making these dances. I was in theater in high school, but then I started to realize I really didn't want to be anyone else. I didn't want to play anyone in a role. I wanted to just present myself and my own feelings and the things that I was thinking about and the things I was interested in. And dance was that sort of perfect way for me to do that. And so I started studying choreography, creating these dances that were kind of insane in some ways, and they would be about, you know, Mongolian cable television or Reaganomics. And
what is a dance about Mongolian cable television or Reaganomics? Like, what does that look like?
I had this, there was eight people on stage, and there was another two people that were on an exercise bike throughout the entire dance. And it was sort of modeled after these. I was started reading about this because this is before, you know, YouTube, but I started reading about this cable television channel in Ulaanbaatar and what the programming was like. But then I just started to imagine what the programming would be like for me. And I was matching this while I was on an exercise bike in the gym in college. And so that started to turn into this thing of, you know, I had these two people on an exercise bike, and then you saw all these sort of crazy vignettes with, you know, Diamante Galas or Susie music or The Cure or Underworld and some of this early electro music with these different vignettes and episodes happening while these people were biking. And then in the end, they kind of all disintegrate. And I got in trouble in that dance also because we flicked off people in the audience at one point. And I knew that the dean of the school was there and directed one of my middle fingers towards him.
Why? Like, explain to me the connection between what sounds like a dance about just a topic that you find interesting, like, oh, isn't this intriguing that there's some strange programming on this station and I wonder what I would like. Why did that intersect with your anger at authority?
I think I was creating these sort of fantastic worlds to escape authority, and also by wearing, you know, especially because it was 1998 or 1997, and these people wearing makeup in Worcester, Ohio, wearing makeup. And I had a duet with me and another man that was a very sensual dance, and then women with other women. And so I was kind of also, that kind of ethos was influencing my work as well, and sort of an anger at, you know, even in college, I was having these really negative experiences. And there we had sort of an early IM system at college. It was called Broadcast. And this guy at one point said he wanted to meet me, and I went to the dorm where he supposedly was, and I was right under the street light, and the dorm he was Andrew's, which was the all-male dorm. And I got there, suddenly all the windows opened up, and the doors opened, and there was about like 30 guys, well, not maybe 15, charging at me, throwing things at me. And I ran into the dorm I was, and then I got all these messages saying, don't ever show up at the dining hall again or you'll be killed. You know, faggot, blah, 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 blah.
Yikes. Well, that certainly is an escalation of the sort of conflicts that you had with the clubs in your neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I had a lot of those kinds of experiences. And then in high school, when I would try to meet people, I had a really negative experience with the first guy that I ever met that was supposedly gay ended up being this 50-year-old man, and he said he was 16. And my car had broken down right at his house, and he, you know, basically became this really terrible experience that was my first sort of experience with anyone. And that those kinds of things made me start to like be angry at gay people, be angry at straight people. So I started taking that and creating my own world.
Yeah, it sounds like you really had a lot of reasons to be angry at people.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, but I also had great, you know, I was angry, but I was using it in a creative way, and I had great friends and was doing things. So, yeah, I had all of this that I was upset about, but I was lucky that I was an artist and that I could make music and I could make dances about it, and instead of doing something else that would be way more destructive.
So where did that take you? So you're making these, learning to do the choreography and express yourself in college, and what happened afterwards?
So I had a sort of moment where I realized, oh, I don't know, I didn't plan for what to do right after college. And I tried to become a bartender in New York, which didn't really last because I didn't prepare very well. And the place I was supposed to stay in it was my friend had checked it out beforehand, but and it said it was fine, and I brought all my stuff in a SUV, and then I got there and I realized it was this burnt out building in Bed-Stuy. So I had I had like $3,000 and no job and no apartment now. And so I tried to do that and then realized this isn't going to happen after about a month, and thought, well, I better go to grad school, and applied to, worked in a theater in Cleveland and stayed in my parents for about a year and a half while I got things together and got into Temple University in Philadelphia and got my MFA in choreography. And that's where I started to really hone, you know, my choreographic process, and also all of that, and studying all these postmodern choreographers. Then that became influential on postmodern music, and that influenced me and wanted me to make my own music.
And so tell me about the music that you're making now.
Well, it's sort of a stem from, I started a podcast called I'm Going to Kill You with a friend of mine, Edward, who was also in some of my bands in high school. And one of the episodes, I had to create my own song. Usually I was in doing music with bands. And I started to realize, like, this was a really rewarding experience because it didn't involve anyone else but myself, and I didn't have to wait for anyone else to have this expression. And then I started creating my own songs and creating videos for them that went along with the songs, and they, it was kind of this exciting new thing for me to do, because as a dancer or as a choreographer, you know, your work is very ephemeral in some ways. There's nothing, even a video of a dance is really never the same as watching a dance and having a live performance. And this was something that was always the same no matter what. So I could create a song and the song was the same 10 years, you know, you could have the same experience. And that was really exciting for me to have these sort of concrete art pieces. And so that's what I've been working on now, is this album that's coming out. And I have about I put out about 5 or 6 singles, and now there's 2 more that are going to come out within the next year that are done, and then there'll be an album that comes along with that.
Do you still have a lot of anger in your work?
I think that I've calmed down a little bit. I think that that anger is what made me who I am, you know, that the my sense of individuality is who has made me who I am. So I'm always sort of doing what makes sense for me and is presenting me in a different way. And a lot of times it is reactive. I know that people might like that I've done something a little bit more about showing an androgynous element. And then, so then I might end up doing my next song. You know, this next song I'm doing is a more kind of butch song, a butch presentation of myself. So there's, you know, I react to what sometimes other people, if I see someone expects something from me, I do react. I think that makes me question all the time, and I think that makes me have to go into new areas all the time, and that's exciting to not be stuck in one place.
What do you put it down to that you don't, that you say you calm down, that you don't have as much anger anymore?
I don't know. My friend Jesse said that, you know, when I was in my 20s, I was glamorous but homicidal, but now I'm just glamorous. So that I used to be like Morgan Fairchild in, I forget the soap, but now I'm more like Sable Colby in Dynasty. Yeah, I think it's years of therapy. I think it's having some really successful experiences in social experiences, having great friends, living life, teaching a class, you know, making art, that those are things that have, you know, knowing what it's, having a long-term relationship for a while, kind of knowing what these things are like, and that's given me sort of some confidence, and that confidence, I think, has made me calmer.
What do you think your work would be like if you hadn't had that angry period?
I don't know if I would have become an artist. I think if I wasn't gay, if I had been born, you know, because I'm a lot like my sister, and I think that maybe if I hadn't had those sort of experiences of isolation or opposition, that I might not have been motivated as much to be an artist, and I have a lot of other things I'm interested in, history and science, so I feel like I might have done something different. But I think that those experiences made me who I am, and I think that in some ways that's exciting that I was able to turn that into something positive and to sort of shine a light on those experiences for other people as well.
Was it difficult ever to give yourself permission to be angry?
Yeah, to a certain degree. I think I always have sort of a self-editing process, and I don't want to come off as angry to other people. And I don't think I am angry as a person, but I do think that I'm a contrarian person, and I'm a person that questions authority when I feel that authority doesn't have the right to question me. And that has served me well, I think. And I think that's also, you know, allowed me to be surrounded by a ton of different types of people. You know, I have straight friends. I have all different types of gay friends. I can go to a circuit party, or I could go to a coffee shop, co-op, vegan meeting, you know, so like I can, but the thing I have in common with all of these people is a sense of individuality that they have, and that they have that sort of like philosophy.
What are the authorities that you've been questioning lately?
Well, there's obviously our disgusting administration, but I think that within the gay community, I feel like a lot of gay men are having a lot of there's a lot of self-esteem issues that go on in our community because we're so terrible to each other, and social media sort of hypes that up, where people are really commodifying and trying to fit into certain molds. And sometimes that process of someone trying to fit into a mold is a really disgusting and disheartening thing to witness. And I think that we all do it to a certain degree because we want to be loved. We want people to think that we're hot. We want people to think we're successful and interesting. It's something that angers me. And I think that I try to vocalize that. And, you know, so some of my music videos or my writing really is a sort of reflection on me trying to present myself as myself and not really care. You know, I'm presenting myself as a sexual person, but I'm not here for your sexuality. I'm presenting myself, I'm talking about my interests, and if they're your interests too, that's great, but who cares if they're not, you know? So I think that's something that people have to do more, you know?
So for folks who want to seek out your stuff and check out your music and your videos, where should they go?
GeorgeAlley.com. And then all of my songs are on iTunes, and they're on YouTube, and they're on Vimeo.
Perfect. Well, George, thanks again so much for joining me.
Well, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me on this.
Big thanks to George for joining me, and check out his latest single, Leave Me Dreaming. I'll have a one-minute excerpt of that at the end of the episode, and you can get the full song at his website, georgeally.com. Let's talk about the 90s, since it did come up quite a bit this week. Particularly, that uniquely 90s feeling of nihilism and ennui that nothing matters, everything's ironic, and that life is lonely, boring, and dumb. That's the thesis of my recommendation this week, which I'm recommending with a caveat. Gregoraki's film The Doom Generation came out in 1995 and is what you might call peak 90s. It's the story of three disaffected youths sneering their way through a grotesquely violent America, guided only by their hunger, their libido, and by brief cameos from folks like Parker Posey and Margaret Cho. It's not heavy on story, and even lighter on any sort of resolution. So you could read a lot into the story depending on what sort of personal baggage you bring. To me, it's a film about early 90s queer HIV anxiety. There's a line early on about AIDS, and throughout the film, the characters are surrounded by images of death, as well as a fascination and wariness about the consequences of their own sexual urges. It is an aggressive bummer, and although you'll likely walk away with lots to think about, you'll also probably develop plenty of dark rain clouds over your head.
But if you've got the stomach for some deep, dark 90s nihilism, The Doom Generation is a rewarding watch, and not just because of these sexy flashes of male skin and the perfect portrait of men's gazes lingering on each other's bodies. The film is an ideal capsule of a period of aimlessness, disillusionment, despair, and fear, and at this point, I'm not sure if I'm referring to the 90s or just being a teenager. Thanks again for listening, and don't forget that starting in February, I'll be releasing monthly bonus episodes of Sewers of Paris, hosting live streams, making videos about LGBT entertainment, and more. That's on top of the regular weekly Sewers episodes, so huge thanks to everyone who supports the show on Patreon. Your support makes it possible for me to make the Sewers of Paris and create new content. And if you're not supporting the show yet, February's going to be a great time to start. Just go to sewersofparis.com and click Support the Show on Patreon. The theme song for the show is Parisian by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. And until next time... croissant.
Sail with me out to sea before the thunder breaks. Sing the songs that sailors sing, play the songs they're paid to bring. When we dream, how we scheme, every line ends, stay with me. Don't leave me alone to fight. I don't wanna say goodnight. Maybe I'm sailing out of mourning for myself. I never knew I could get very far. The light from this moon reflects all of your dreams. Then again, they're not. When I close my eyes, all these things I want to say about the sailors and the sailors and a love that does not wane. When they are not close, maybe yeah, maybe not. Just leave me dreaming. If you let me go.